I suppose, yeah, we'll just get going. Barb and I are
partners.
We're married. We've been married for 37 years. And have been pretty much like Catholic workers from the beginning. I first ran into we met at Iowa State University, and then we both, I was going to be a veterinarian, and I didn't do that.
That's a hard school for vet men.
It's a hard school, yeah. I was going to be a veterinarian. Her degree is in psychology and
family systems.
And as it is, we we both went to seminary in Chicago for urban youth ministry. So it was a fantastic program that was put together by a guy who was a terrific friend of ours, Bud Eipelma, well known around Chicago for work that he'd done with gangs, and we worked with an organization called Young Life. It's like an evangelical organization that works with kind of disenfranchised high school students who just didn't like church anymore. So my background is Lutheran. Barb's background is Catholic. We met at Iowa State in like different evangelical sort of things, and then I ended up going to seminary in Chicago at a Covenant seminary. And if you know the Covenant Church, there's some here in
Sanctuary.
Yeah, there's some here in Minneapolis. And Covenant is kind of like Lutheran, but they like different pastry. It's pretty much the difference. So when we were going, I got there a year before Barb, and the first year I was there, I was looking at a conference that was happening in L.A., a youth workers conference, just how to take kids to camp better, or, you know, whatever you do with high school students. And as I was looking at the brochure or the folder on this big board, our trainer walked by, and I said, "Well, so who are good people to see? There's so many options of workshop leaders. I mean, who do I see up all?" So he kind of went through and pointed out a few that he recommended. Said, "This guy's good." This, and one of the people that he pointed to was a fellow named LaDon Sheets, and he said. He said, "Sheets is good, but you got to watch out for Sheets." So it's like, okay, whatever that means. I'm not quite sure what that means. So I went out, and I couldn't avoid him because he was one of the keynote speakers. He gave this talk on incarnational discipleship, which pretty much like changed who I was as a person. And it's pretty nice to like run into those kind of people. LaDon is actually a connection between us and Ched and Steve Clemens. Does anybody here know? Did anyone here know LaDon? He's got a great story, okay, and that's why I'm going back to there to get. It's kind of the start of our path. Is LaDon was raised in the Pentecostal church in Texas. His dad was a minister, so up in Lubbock, and LaDon was always involved with his dad and his church, did everything you could possibly do, played the organ, was a janitor, did all those things. When he went to college, he went through college on ROTC, and then he joined the Strategic Air Command and was a captain on B-52s, flying those big hydrogen bombs towards the Soviet Union to fail-safe, you know? Remember the movie? And so if you went at fail-safe, that's where they tell you either you're going to attack them or you got to turn around. So he did that while he was in Strategic Air Command. And then he came out of Strategic Air Command and went back to graduate school, got an MBA, and was working his way up the ladder when at IBM. He got hired at IBM, ended up at corporate headquarters in New York, started going to Riverside Church in New York, and then he ran into Clarence Jordan, of all people, from Koinonia. And Clarence, in the way that only Clarence can do, you know, unpacked the cotton patch version of the Gospels. And LaDon took it in, and he took it seriously. And he, in his first baby steps, started wearing black armbands over his $400 Brooks Brothers suits when he went to work at IBM because of their part, the part that they were doing in the automated air war in Indochina. And after a period of time, decided, you know what, I just can't do this anymore. I'm going to quit my job and move to Koinonia. So the people at IBM said, Don, you can't do that. I mean, if you need a break, well, 6 months off, full pay, you know, do what you got to do, but come back. He said, no, I'm done. So he did. He left IBM, went to Koinonia, joined the leadership there, and shortly after he was there is when Clarence died. And so he quickly moved up into leadership of Koinonia. And you're familiar with Koinonia, right? That's where Habitat for Humanity came out of. It was an interracial community in South Georgia, started in the late 40s. Clarence Jordan was a Greek biblical scholar out of Southern Baptist Seminary, translated the Cotton Patch version. It's that book is several books from Clarence are at the book table. But they went through a lot during the 40s and 50s with blacks and whites living at a farm in the South together, and then they started build, and they got bombed, they got shot at, their buildings burned down. So it was quite the bold experiment to do back then. Anyway, LaDon ends up there, and then he and another friend started protesting at Fort Benning because it's right there. And the people of Koinonia at one point asked them to consider leaving because it was starting to bring hostilities back to the community that they thought they'd gotten away from. And next thing you know, they did leave, and they went to Jonah House in Baltimore, which was a community set up by Phil Berrigan and Liz McAllister when they were working on Phil Berrigan. You know Phil Berrigan? Dan Berrigan? Yeah. So when he got out of jail for Catonsville and the Baltimore Four, they had to live in Baltimore. He was on probation. They started Jonah House. So that's where LaDon ended up. Yeah. So LaDon Sheets is like our best friend, and many people that we're here because of. I'm here because of LaDon. I think you are too.
Absolutely.
So is Steve Clemens. And LaDon, like, he barely wrote a word. Like this guy writes books. LaDon didn't do that. He wrote when he was in jail. He would write letters to judges and letters to people and letters to whatever. He was a correspondent. That's what LaDon. He left no written legacy. There's really nothing out there about LaDon and his life, what he did. There's almost nothing there. But LaDon, his practice was to go to nuclear weapons facilities, climb over the fence, put himself into deadly force zones. He would pray, and then he'd go to jail, and he'd non-cooperate with prison, and they'd call him up and have interviews with him, and he'd just say, well, are they still making nuclear weapons? And they'd say, yeah, they are. Well, I can't work then. So he would do that, do a sentence, get out, recover. He went out to a monastery in Colorado to do that. Sometimes he came to our farm. He did a lot of hospice with people with cancer because he was well familiar with that. So left no written legacy and went from being groomed to be pretty big muckety-muck in IBM to having a backpack and a Voltron Defender of the Universe pillow. And that was about it. That was what LaDon had when he got cancer and he died of cancer. So
they wrapped him in a buried in a farm workers cemetery in California without any kind of casket. They just put him in a laid him out, and so they put his library card. And then he took Greyhound everywhere. So they went to the Greyhound station and said, "Our friend has died. He's done probably 1,000,000 miles on the bus. Can we get a one-way ticket to heaven?" And they printed it. So he was buried with his one-way ticket to heaven. I don't know if his backpack. I don't know about his pillowcase either.
But
that's how he went out.
So LaDon, seriously impacted a lot of us. And I remember after going to this conference, that's where I ran into the Catholic Worker. He was staying at the Worker House before they were at Britannia. I mean, this is really early on in the LA Catholic Worker, and I'd never heard of the Catholic Worker. So we went to the house where he was staying, and we was like, wow, this is different. So I got back to Chicago, and went down to see my seminary advisor. And I remember he was in the basement office, and I knocked on his door. He opened the door, or I opened the door, and I'm standing there just crying. And I said, "I saw Sheets." And he knew I was done. You're laughing. He knows. So the one place you can hear about LaDon is, I think on the LA Worker webpage, they have a cassette tape that's been digitalized of the talk that I heard him give at the conference in 76. You can hear it. It's amazing. And then one of the books in the book place is one of his favorite books called Tomorrow's Child by Ruben Alves. It's, you got to get it. You got to read it. It's because LaDon said you got to read it. And when it was reissued by Whippenstock, the author, they had to find the author in Brazil before they could do it. And the author in Brazil, Ruben Alves, wrote the new foreword, and it was all about LaDon. That's a story that changed me. And so I'm a nut. I'm a full-blown, crazy guy. And
sanity balance. Right here.
Yeah, that's why we have to do these things together, right?
Can you say the book again?
Tomorrow's Child. Tomorrow's Child, Ruben Alves. There's a copy at the table. So, fast forwarding through, oh my gosh, years and years. We were doing youth ministry.
We lasted 1 year in Young Life after graduating from seminary. And sold all our stuff, moved into our car, and went with the Brethren Volunteer Service for a year, thinking we'd take the naive edge off our commitment to nonviolence by going to Belfast and working with Protestant and Catholic kids. But it was 79, and the Troubles were extremely critical there, and they had closed the program before we probably even saw it in the book. So we lived in Eastern Kentucky for a year with the Brethren Volunteer Service, and then felt a call to Jonah House. We had been out to a couple of their gatherings, and Liz said, "Maybe you guys, after you're done with Brethren Volunteer Service, want to move to the house. So I'm not sure what she saw in us, because we were really two suburban kids, you know, just a couple years married. But she extended the invitation, and we went there and lived in Baltimore for 3 years, and took on the Pentagon, State Department, and White House on a regular basis in 1980 to 83, which is where we met Chad. Came to the house one day. Very intense. People say, oh, you lived in Baltimore, you must have done this, this, and this. And we said, are you kidding? It was the 80s. It was the early 80s. It was Reagan in the White House. No, we didn't do anything. We didn't even eat crab cakes.
Never had a crab cake.
So we went back. But we started having kids, and had grandparents that were important in our lives, so we moved back to the Midwest with the thought of continuing the resistance that we had learned pretty up close and personal out there, lifestyle in a rural setting. Mike's grandma had a farm in near Grand Rapids, Michigan. He spent all his summers there. I didn't have a farming background, but even that year in Kentucky, 1 year in Baltimore, just felt like we needed a balance to our strong no commitment to say yes to something really positive. And so that's what we moved to Wisconsin to do. And it took us a couple years to find the property that you are seeing and establish our place. And we're 28 years at this place. So this whole workshop of this whole weekend on talking about place, we realize how much grace there is in our lives to have moved to this land with nothing on it. And we bought bare land, and to have built houses and established a life that reflects value, reflects sacrament, reflects a lot of grace in work and lifestyle. And so when people come to our farm, it is easy to talk about lots of things because the context is there.
Yeah, and we kind of like mystery, even though I'm not Catholic. You know, evangelicals have to have it all laid out. They have to have answers, and they have answers to prayer. And they're very clear answers to prayer. When we were at Iowa State, there were people who, like with navigators, who stopped setting their alarm clocks, and they would pray that God would get them up in the morning to go to class, and if they didn't make it, then it was like God didn't want me to go to class. I mean, do you know anybody like that? There's pretty creepy people out there doing stuff in the name of Jesus. So when we left to come back, I mean, we left Baltimore with a simple prayer that somewhere out there, somewhere, we're going to find an abandoned house on a farm, because all this consolidation takes place and the farms get bigger and bigger and nobody lives in the houses. And someone's going to be happy to have us there, and we'll start resisting nuclear weapons in northern Wisconsin, which is what Project... That's why we went to northern Wisconsin. Project ELF was a weapon system back then. It was the trigger to initiate first strike nuclear war against the Soviet Union. Hunt for Red October. Anybody see that?
Yep.
Yeah. ELF, they talk about ELF in there. Transmitter, mile-long cables on submarines, both missile submarines and hunter-killer submarines. And the reason we went to northern Wisconsin in Project ELF was if someone decided, well, you know, we have to attack the Soviet Union, otherwise we're done for, the signal would go out from northern Wisconsin. It would go down into the ground, bounce off the bedrock, go up to the ionosphere, bounce off the ionosphere, set up a 2,500-mile-long standing wave going around the planet at the speed of light, could penetrate way down into the ocean. And the missile subs and the fast attack subs could be coordinated simultaneously, and the missile subs would come up, get into conventional contact, and they would be told to launch their missiles at their targets, which would be hardened silos, the command and control centers. The idea was to hit all their stuff while it's still on the ground. And while that was going on, the missile subs would be, or the fast attack subs, which trail the Soviet missile subs, would use their nuclear tip torpedoes, blow them up, and that's how we would win nuclear war. And the signal would come out from northern Wisconsin. So when we started this farm, we weren't necessarily like farming. We had a big garden. We fed ourselves. We brought vegetables into the Catholic Worker in Minneapolis, but we were manic anti-nuclear activists, and we'd go 2 hours up to Project Delph, an hour and a half over to Minneapolis, and be taking on Honeywell with their involvement in nuclear weapons, and just we were consumed, probably because we had kids and we knew too much, and we just like jump into things like that. So, in 2004, they actually shut off Project Delph. We won, which was pretty cool. And the media called us and said, well, what do you think about them shutting off Project Delph?
We hadn't quite heard. We had worked with Senator Feingold for a long time on shutting it down, so it was surprising. I was sewing a prom dress. Wisconsin Public Radio calls and said, so, we hear they've shut down Project Delph. How do you feel about it? And just kind of say, I'm not sure why today and not 25 years ago, but we're glad for it. So it was one of our victories. We've had a couple along the way.
And one of the interesting ones that, again, ties into the conference here was native spearfishing back in the 80s. Anybody remember, were you around here for that? Right. The Tribble brothers fished off reservation, got into federal court. Barbara Crabb said, you can fish off reservation. The treaty rights don't confine you to reservation. You can fish, hunt, gather anywhere you want in the ceded territories. And riots broke out on boat landings. It was crazy.
The context of that was that the spearfish, that Barbara Crabb decision came at the same time that the DNR cut bag limits. So
For walleye.
So it was a perfect storm of people looking as a cause-effect, and it wasn't a cause-and-effect at all. But the white anglers really went pretty scarily crazy on the boat landings, and we organized some witness of nonviolence on the boat landings. Did a terrible job the first year. The media was, you know, really setting up this protest, you know, the different people on the boat landing, and I felt like we did a really poor job and did not do the tribe any good, hardly at all, by being on the landings. That summer we trained hundreds of people from several states, came in for witness and nonviolence training, and the next year we were silent witnesses on the boat landings, and the sheriff called us in and said, the governor is saying he wants everybody off the boat landings. Only the native spears are, you stay up. And we said, we have an invitation from the tribe, so we're taking that invitation. We'll be there. And by the end of the season, the sheriff's department was calling our number and saying, how many people do you have coming out tonight? We hear it's going to be a big crowd. Can you get more people? And essentially, I think it was very boring not having any. Everybody was really disciplined in a silent witness. It de-escalated things. The local paper just credited the witness for nonviolence to bring the white anglers into some kind of
civility.
Yeah. And the violence stopped on the boat landing after that year.
And then the whole thing just kind of went away, and it's just not an issue.
Was that 2005, or when was that?
It was 89, 90.
Yeah. We live right down from a reservation, right around the corner from a reservation. One of the Round Lake Band, they're one of the last bands to get land in Wisconsin, so they don't have one big res. There's pockets of them all over the place, the St. Croix band. So So, we're moving towards like what we do now. when we had a chance to stop being so crazy. We started farming a little bit more. We had some more people come to the farm. We put up a few more buildings. You're just seeing all kinds of our buildings that we have there. It's kind of, we called it Center for the Study of Nonviolence Community and Sustainable Living. It was kind of like built out of Mother Earth News. We raised money to do it. It was totally a gift. The whole thing was a gift that is like, okay, I guess we have to do this now. We sent out a letter, said, okay, everybody, we don't have any money. We do war tax resistance. We can't borrow money from banks. Consider sending us $100. And if we get $20,000, that should be enough to buy the land. The land was $12,000 for 57 acres back in 82.
86.
Or 8. Yeah, 86. 86, excuse me. And, I mean, that was next to nothing because it had agricultural land on it. And so we mailed this letter out to people in our address book that we picked up from when we were Jonah House, and had some local peacemakers in the Minneapolis area take our letter and put a cover letter on it and say, hey, these people are good people. Do you listen to this? And in 6 weeks, we'd raised $20,000. It's crazy. 6 weeks. Then we went out to purchase the land with Char Madigan and Reed Foster, who ran the Catholic Worker House in Minneapolis. And the day that we went to sign the papers and everything, the realtor told us that the next day somebody was going to come in and buy that land for hunting. So we got there just in time. So we kind of looked at that and went, all right, somebody wants us to do this. It's like you can't manipulate grace, right? Grace just happens. Mm-hmm. You put yourself out there. You do everything you know you should do. And hopefully grace happens. And so when this happened, it was like, okay, we have to do this. So we started doing it, and people started coming. We started building more. Barb and John came, and Bonnie came, and people have been coming and going from there, you know, since 86. We put up the first house in 86, moved in 87. When we moved into our house, it's an 1892 recycled log building that came from northern Wisconsin that was donated. We got it, had a historic building donated to the Catholic Worker. Put it back together and put all kinds of
this is it. That's the house.
That's the house. Put all kinds of, you can see big glass on the south side. So the buildings that we built are straight out of Mother Earth News. Gray water systems, composting toilets, greenhouses.
We do not pee in good water.
We do not pee in water. So we were very, that's right. Actually, I'm cleaning our toilet out right now. So we have a urine diverting toilet chute on our composting toilet. So when we pee, it goes into a 55-gallon barrel in the basement. When it fills up, during the growing season, we use the pee, mix it 8 parts water to 1 part pee, and it like makes things grow like crazy. It has everything. It's not just nitrogen. It's it's phosphorus and potassium. It's all there. And then the poop composts, and we bring it out, and we don't put it on food because we don't need to, because of the way we have plenty of stuff to use on food.
How long do you let the poop sort of compost with other stuff?
The poop goes about a year. I clean it out like yearly, the composting toilet. When there's a lot of people there, it needs to be yearly. When there's not a lot of people there, I've let it go up to 3 years.
It's a homemade one. So it's not one of those commercial ones. So that's a big tank.
It's a big tank.
It's a really big tank in the basement.
And when it comes out, I mean, it is so composted that we have this second grade field trip that comes to the farm every year. It used to be for maple syrup, and now it's for the kind of farming we do. One of the things I do with these second graders is we show them our baby pigs, we show them our baby chicks, we was a solar panel on there? We've got a 10,000, 3 years ago, we got a 10,000 watt photovoltaic grid tie. Nuke Watch is a national organization that does anti-nuclear organizing. They got a donation. Someone said, do whatever you want. So we put this photovoltaic grid tie in. So since it's been up and running, we are using 40% of electricity and selling 60% of electricity back to the power company. So we are a bona fide power plant. We show the kids that. If we just show them all this stuff. We show them how to turn sunshine into electricity. And then I take them over to the compost pile, of the poop compost pile, because we have other compost piles too. And I just stick my hands in there and go, you see this right here? This used to be poop. This toilet paper's gone, everything's gone, and they're like, wow, you're touchy poop. And it's like, no, it's good. You do this and this, and this turns into soil. So the second graders are all about poop, man, because they're in second grade. So we've been doing all of that for a long time. There was a couple people that lived at the farm for maybe 3 years that did a CSA. You know what that is? Community Support Agriculture. They were there, then they went to other places too. And it was 7 years ago where, after reading Michael Pollan's Omnivore's Dilemma and Barbara Kingsolver, Animal Vegetable Miracle, and learning about Joel Salatin, who was in Pollan's book, we started doing animals. So we got two pigs in the summer, and that was the first. And then we got some, like, 30 chickens.
Yep, we got practice chickens.
Meat birds. We didn't have any egg birds at the time. And, raised them, everything went well. We were doing rotationally grazed everything. We have about a 2-acre garden that you're seeing here, and the pigs are a part of a 4-year rotation in the garden where it's potatoes followed by pigs, followed by cover crop, followed by vegetables. And that's what happens, and the pigs dig up rocks, they do great tilling, and so the pigs are a part of the garden rotation. And then the chickens are in the front in 11 acres where we do the steers. And then we started getting into rotational grazing. So we bought, we just started doing steers. And we had maybe 8 paddocks, which are, there's a big perimeter fence, and then you chop it up into smaller chunks with electric fence. And we would, move them through this all during the course of the summer. And we're reading books on it, and they say, you really should move them to get the best effect. You should move them every day. And we would, read stuff and look at it and think, oh, man, it's got to be hard to move them every day. So 2 years ago, we actually came up with a system to move them every day, and I hopefully will show you a movie if it works out. And the concept is this. There's a guy named Alan Savory. Anybody hear of Alan Savory? He's a British ecologist, grew up in South Africa, studied down there, was working in the national parks and, trying to mitigate preserving the parks with people who are doing cattle grazing. And it's all about desertification and overgrazing and how do you stop this and all. And to make a long story short, came up with this method called holistic grazing, mob grazing, managed intensive grazing. And what that's about, it's like a cotton picking miracle. Okay, so there's like almost 5,000 mammals, species on the planet. 150 of them, about, are ruminant animals. And ruminant animals have 4 stomachs. So they eat, it goes into one stomach, stays there for a while, comes back up, and they just kind of regurgitate it. They bring it up, chew their cud, send it back down. And by the time it's all done, they can turn cellulose into usable protein. How do they do that? So the theory behind this kind of grazing and soil building is that before civilization got in the way, and that means like before there were cities and roads and commerce and all those kind of things, that you can't just have huge herds of ruminant animals, you know, running around anywhere. Let's look in the U.S. with buffalo and elk. They would be in herds of tens, if not 100,000 animals, moving into an area, eating, pooping, peeing, trampling, leaving, because they've got predators all around them, keeping them in a clump, and the ones on the outside would get peeled off by the predators, but they're always moving, and they may not come back to the same place for months at a time. And that was happening in the United States, it was happening in South America, in the savannas in Africa, it was happening in the steppes in Asia, and that's how topsoil got built for thousands and thousands of years. 45% of this planet is like grasslands. You always hear about trees. Environmentalists want to plant trees and get carbon dioxide out of the air with trees, but in properly grazed grasslands, you can store more carbon dioxide faster in grasslands than you can, like an acre of grasslands, more than in an acre of mature forest. Because you've always got this movement going on with plants being chewed down and new sprouts coming up, and they get fertilized by the action of the cattle. So we started doing that, and what we do with the electric fence is we're mimicking predators, okay? If you drive anywhere around on an interstate in the United States and you see a huge open field with cows out there kind of all over the place and they're lollygagging under a tree and they're just, you know, looking like they're having like a lovely pastoral time, that's wrong. That's not how those animals work in systems. When you have that going on, in a big field with cows spread out everywhere, is they both overgraze it and undergraze it at the same time, because they, like us, have their favorite things that they like to eat. So they're grazing down their favorites. In the meantime, the stuff that they don't like grows, matures, lignifies, gets big, goes to seed, spreads, and sunlight can't penetrate to the new growth below it. So the stuff that they don't eat spreads. The stuff that they love gets chewed down until it's like a golf course. And so they're overgrazing and undergrazing at the same time. So if you use this electric fence to clump them into smaller groupings, they eat everything. They get competitive with each other. And they're always moving. So we have a system, we put them in, and they're there for a day. They move the next, we just keep moving them, and we move their water. We have a simple way to move water. And there's a few people out there that say, ah, this is silly, it doesn't help. It's like a miracle. There's people who are doing this kind of grazing, who've been doing it for a long time. If we can get the Wi-Fi going, we'd show you a 12-minute clip on some guys in North Dakota and Canada who are doing amazing stuff. But Gabe Brown, who is a rock star farmer in North Dakota, when he started doing this kind of grazing 20 years ago, he almost lost his farm. They're always losing money. Somehow they ran into Savory, started doing this kind of grazing. Everything bounced back. They started going away from monoculture to a cocktail mix of legumes, grasses, forbs, which are flowers, and a lot of those kind of flowers are to attract pollinators and all. And in like a 20-year period, his land went from a half an inch per hour of rain infiltration to 8 inches of rain per hour rain infiltration, from a half an inch to 8 inches per hour after doing this kind of grazing for 20-some years. boosted his carbon content in his soil from like 2% up to 8%. And when you do that, you're taking carbon out of the air. When carbon interfaces with the oceans, it's bad because it becomes carbonic acid. The oceans acidify, the reefs die, everything. But when that happens, when it hits grass and you got photosynthesis going on, and the ruminants are pruning and they're pooping, peeing, fertilizing, doing all of what they do, you are like creating carbon dioxide vacuum cleaners. And it works. We've seen it work. In the past 2 years since we started moving them every day, we've seen our pastures transformed in just 2 years compared to what they were when we were just moving them like every week or 10 days when we didn't know what we were doing. So the thing that I like about our kind of that part of our farming and being where we are is we got the 10,000 watt photovoltaic grid tie, you know, keeping carbon dioxide from going in the air in the first place. And then we got all of this pasture that's sucking carbon dioxide out of the ground, putting it into the ground, and feeding the most important animals on a farm, which are the microorganisms that are 3 feet under our feet. Those are the most important animals on any farm. In one teaspoon of healthy soil, there are trillions of little animals. There's more animals in a teaspoon of healthy soil than human beings on the planet. And when you let that all happen, they build fertility. Mycorrhiza start mining down into the depths below your feet and start pulling up fertility. Sir Albert Howard, you know, wrote about that in the 30s and 40s. Father of organic agriculture. There's a lot of pop books on that right now that are like holy cow, this is great stuff. You don't need smoke and mirrors, you don't need high technology to take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. All you need is lots of photosynthesis going on, and it's the job of ruminant animals to be out there pruning, pooping, peeing, leaving. It's all about recovery. And one of the books that got me started on this was The Soil Will Save Us. And one of the little clips in there that she talks about is that at any given time, with all of the grasslands that are on the planet, if this kind of grazing was going on only 11% of those grasslands, we could suck all the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere that's been put in since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution in a matter of years, not decades. And that at any given time, 22% of these grasslands are laying fallow. And you don't want them to be fallow because then the plants grow up, they mature, they lignify, and then the sun can't get through and then you have problems. So,
what does lignify mean?
It means they become mature and the stems get hard. They get hard. And some people say, well, cows, you know, they have methane. You know, it's a problem. They're farting. One thing about plants and cows and methane is whenever plants grow and mature and die and just lay there and they start to oxidize, they're giving off methane. So somebody's got to, you know, the people who really hate cows. There's a lot of people who really hate cows. They say they're destroying the planet. Got to get rid of them. They need to start doing some more, work on, so how much more methane is being given up when you send these plants through their rumen and then it comes out and fertilizes, as opposed to the plants growing, dying, and just giving off methane as they oxidize. There's a lot of work that needs to be done. On that, because we got to build our case to people who think that cows are a problem. I just read the other 2 days ago when I was getting ready for this. People say, "Well, if you grazed all this beef, It would just take up all of the agricultural land that there is in the United States. There wouldn't be a room to grow any food for anybody. And I don't think that's true because, well, I know it's not true. Well, I don't know it's not true. What I was told and what I was reading is that when some people who were doing a lot of work on this did the math, they figured on just the grasslands that are available right now in the United States, they could handle 35 million cattle doing this kind of grazing. And there's about 26 million cattle in feedlots at any given time. So
it's the factory farms plus cows that make these bad things happen.
Yeah.
It's not the free-ranging cows or
the
managed cows like you do.
Yeah. The other thing that we do with our cows that is, again, nature, is chickens. So we run chickens through where the cows are. Birds and ruminant animals just go together like peas and carrots because the cows poop, the chickens come through, scratch through the cows' pies, eat the larva, keep the fly populations down, spread out the cow pies. You just see it everywhere. You know, when impalas are going through the Serengeti and flamingos, I don't know, whoever's there. You know, going through it all, doing their thing.
Have you connected all with the Dreams of Wild Health? We did the tour yesterday with them. They think of the 10-acre farm.
Yeah.
And they're pretty ingenious at what they're doing there.
Yeah. There's some ingenious farming going on out there right now, and there needs to be.
Yeah.
So that's what we're doing. I'm convinced that this is real. And I follow this like crazy. I'm a news junkie. I'm always looking at all this stuff. And there's a few people who poo-poo it, but I'm convinced it's real. And that one of the other books that was written that's out there is Cows Save the Planet. I think they can. If we manage them correctly, if we mimic nature like before there were us, and so the big herds went around, did all their things. The image of the lion and the lamb lying down together, that's a great image for peace, but for ecology it really sucks because predators have their place. And the place of predators in this big system of ruminant animals is to keep them on the move. You might have followed in Yellowstone, they reintroduced wolves. And what did the reintroduction of wolves do? Change the course of the river. Because what was happening was the elk, without elves, without wolves, got lazy, and they would go down in the river, they would graze away all the grass by the banks, and so there was not enough roots there to hold the river banks together when water came rushing through. And so when they reintroduced wolves, now the elk are grazing, but they're looking over their shoulders like, we've got to get out of here. These guys are over here. And it literally changed the flow of the river. So, nice image for peace, but there's a place for predators. And where there's not predators, there's electric poly wire.
And that's what you don't want to touch too much of.
And you don't want to touch too much of it. So if you were to drive along Interstate 80 out through Nebraska and see a huge big pasture and someone doing this kind of grazing, you'd have like multiple acres and then 800 cows shoulder to shoulder right here. And you'd think, why are they doing that? That seems cruel. I should call somebody. But that's what wolves do, and that's what lions do, and that's what they are supposed to do. So that's the kind of grazing that we do. And there's another thing that, with water, I've got to try to get over there. Barb, tell them something while I'm finding this.
You can tell Mike is the farmer. I'm the social worker. So other things we do at the farm is we do a lot of educational work with students. All sorts of opportunities come our way. We've been housing a Syrian woman for the last 3.5 years and kind of walked with her on her path. Her family just did that scary thing you've heard time and time again on the news with the little boat to Turkey and sinking and all that sort of stuff. lot of education on healthy food and why stuff like this makes sense. I did this wedding that I won't even begin to tell you of the camo and camo wedding dresses and wraps and all this. It was not my usual crowd for what kind of food I usually make. But served a kale salad to the 200 people at this camo wedding, and I picked it that morning and chopped it really finely and made a terrific dressing. And I had so many people of those 200 people come up and say, "What am I eating? This is so good. It's like kale." It's like, "You're kidding. I've never eaten kale." But we're changing habits of people just the way people eating real food, they change. And all of a sudden they get interested and they see the value of eating local and eating fresh and eating seasonally. This has been a whole shift in mindset. I grew up in Minnesota, so you go for the deal, you go for what's on sale at the grocery store. And then over the 28 years we've been at the farm, how differently I look at what I'm planning for a meal. If you came to my house, it would be what we eat so close to our garden now. We eat sometimes 80, 90, 98% out of stuff that is just, 100 yards away in our meat. Our meat is really a condiment. We've not changed our habits on our consumption of meat, really, even though we grow so much. We're able to sell some, a lot of it. But
Most of it.
But we are grateful for every animal that we have. And our little cute little pigs, we have the Harry Potter series this year. We have Harry Trotter, we have Hermione, we have Luna Tastes Good, and we have Professor Snout. So we harvest.
Did you see us snuggling with the pigs?
Yeah, we nap with our pigs. We actually harvest them ourselves, so the day of reckoning comes and they get their feed with apples, raisins, maple syrup, and a quart of vodka each. And those guys are so relaxed when they go out, and they don't really, there's no squealing, there's no trauma in our barnyard on Butcher Day, except for us. They're about 8 months.
No, more like 10, 11.
10, 11 months. Oh, yeah. I guess they're on our farm like 6, 7. We get them in April, May, and they go out in November.
And they're out a couple months when they come to us. This year, the pigs we got came from the Lake City Catholic Order. They do pigs.
So they're like 250 pounds.
And you can all butchering yourself.
Yeah, we do. We do the chickens ourselves because you can do 1,000 chickens a year per farmer without inspection. As long as it has a lot number, which can be the date and the location, and there's no way we're doing 1,000 chickens. I mean, this year we did 250 chickens, 250 meat birds. We have about 30 egg birds, and 30 of them went to a wedding that we actually had to take into a USDA place to be done because the caterer was from somewhere and they had to be done that way. But we butcher our own chickens and we butcher our own pork. We sell bootleg hog, because you can't do that. USDA doesn't let you do that, and people love our bootleg hog. The steers we do bring in to a state inspected place in town. Actually, the two big ones from this year are going in on the 19th of October. I love doing math on this kind of stuff, and I figured out with the animals that we have with the number of animals that we did do this year, with the an adult my size, I need 7 ounces of protein per day, and if I was getting my protein from just our animals, and not in potatoes or not in rice and not in anything else. If all my protein came from, like, the beef that I ate or the chicken that I ate, we prepared somewhere over 6,000 individual daily servings of protein out of the animals that we did this year. And in my new understandings, especially of ruminant animals, of the beef, of the cattle. They really are the most environmental meat that we have, because chickens and pigs need some grain, some more protein, either grain or nuts, or they have to have more. They don't have ruminants. They can't just be raised on grass. And so beef is really the best environmental protein that we grow in terms of meat. And the interesting thing about cattle, beef cattle, is depending on the breed, 60 to 85% of what they eat turns into poop and pee. So meat is really a byproduct. It's not even their job to become meat. But when we feed them this way, it literally changes the chemistry of the fat and the vitamin content and stuff. And it's just like the most terrific stuff. If you have anybody had grass finished, not just grass fed, but grass finished, I mean, there's nothing like it. But
so you do feed some beef to your chicken.
It's grain to our chicken.
You don't feed beef to your chicken.
No.
Okay. I misunderstood what you were saying.
Yeah. Grain.
Okay. Grain.
I thought you were saying, implying that you were feeding your chicken and your pigs some of your cow meat.
No, grain has to go to chickens and pigs. But the other thing that's interesting, okay, is like pigs are omnivores, as are chickens. Mm-hmm. And I love the labels for, it's this egg is a vegetarian egg. It's like, you don't want to eat a vegetarian egg. Because a vegetarian, like if you got that and says this comes from vegetarian chickens, you are looking at a chicken that is hermetically sealed in a building that's not getting bugs, not getting worms. You know, they're getting like the grain that they're fed from the guys that have 20,000 chickens in a confined area. Chickens love meat. They eat bugs. Our chickens that we move around every day get 20% of their nutrition from grass and bugs. And they will eat meat. And when we butchered our chickens, when we butchered our pigs last year, it was on into November. It was cold. It was actually kind of freezing the day we did it. It was a little difficult. We butchered 4 pigs in one day. Our egg birds actually live in a greenhouse by the garden in the wintertime, because it will be 60 degrees in there, whether it's 20 below or not, if there's sunshine. And we took the guts and the skins. We skin the pigs after we kill them. We took the four 250-pound pigs worth of entrails and skins and just put it in the greenhouse with the chickens. They made it all go away. Every single bit of it was gone by the time spring rolled around. And it would freeze every night, and then it would thaw out during the day, and the chickens would go do their thing. And two of the pigs, they ate their grain. They really ate their vodka grain. So their stomachs were like, I'm looking at this stomach going, why is the stomach so swollen up? Is it poking? It's like it's full of alcohol grain. And the chickens had the alcohol grain. I never saw a drunk chicken, but they made the alcohol grain all go away too. So chickens and pigs are omnivores. The physiology of a pig is so close to humans that they do alcohol studies, and they do all kinds of different studies between pigs and humans. And that's why with halal and kosher, that was before they understood all that was going on there with trichinosis and stuff. Pigs and people are so close that disease could get passed because of that kind of thing. That's how close the physiology is of a pig to a human.
Okay, so Mike, it seems like in recent years, this debate about cows is getting more and more polarized.
It is,
right?
Way.
And so you got people saying cows are going to save the planet, and then you got the cowspiracy people, who are saying it's the worst greenhouse effect.
Yeah.
Those of us who are lay people and not otherwise ideologically committed around meat or vegetarian are a little confused about this. And then the question of carbon sequestration, right? It's not just the cows, but it's the question of carbon.
the Cowspiracy people making some very strong claims, and then the cows will save the planet. Can you help us sort through the basic claims? I mean, you make it clear what side you're on, but I just wonder how you navigate this.
Yeah, how do I navigate it? I think a lot of the real big, like, naysayers on cows are coming from Meat is Murder.
Yeah. Although they're not very transparent about that.
No.
But so what about their claims then about greenhouse gases?
Yeah, I'm not sure where they get it. I mean, it's like with the tobacco companies. You know, they could hire scientists to say tobacco's fine, and who else? You know, you can find someone who will back your claims, and I'm sure it would go the same way with like people like me would lean towards scientists or could lean towards scientists who go, yeah, this is great stuff, and somebody else is saying this is horrible stuff. I can't give you like a cut and dry. My impression from all that I've read and all that I've done and all that I've seen is that whatever methane lasts 7 years. I mean, it's carbon dioxide is forever, and it comes in and out of the carbon cycle depending on what's going on. Can either be put right, you know, it becomes like a solid in the ground, or there is a time when it can be gaseous and can be let loose. But for the most part, the best that I can discern out of it all is the methane question. And again, it's like, okay, so you run these plants through a rumen and there's methane, or you let the plants grow and decay and they oxidize, and there's methane. So in my looking at it all, I'm saying that the benefit of carbon sequestration with cows doing what they do is for real, and it overwhelms what they say that cows shouldn't be around at all.
But isn't that an unfair comparison? Because actually most cows are not raised the way that you raise them.
That's where most of the Cowspiracy, I mean, the Cowspiracy guys don't like the way we do it, because they say they're alive 6 months longer. That the animals that go through a feedlot are like 18 months, and our guys go like 2 years. So they say it's worse to have the cows alive 6 months longer than running them through a feedlot, where you know, it's not just methane, it's also all of the energy that goes into grain and the harvesting of grain, the processing and moving of grain to the feedlots, and that with animals with a rumen, that they're not supposed to eat grain, so they have to feed them antibiotics with the grain, otherwise they develop acidosis. So that 80% of the antibiotics that are produced in the United States today go directly into animal feed. And that's another place where it's going to jump up and bite us, is that's where a lot of resistance is coming from. Just routinely feeding antibiotics to animals to fatten them up.
And I jump into research. I studied animal rights as well as some ecology. But I think back from our previous sessions, it's a circular worldview or a linear worldview. And our agricultural business is so dominant within our military-industrial complex, so that the biggest thing is factory farming compared to local farming. That's completely two different worldviews, completely. And so the arguments about do you eat meat or whatnot, that is completely a false narrative or a weak narrative of the reality, which is do you live sustainably with nature, or do you have a linear worldview? And to me, that question is a particular question from 2015, but you have to take in entire world history and how humans have developed with meat
and how our Industrial Revolution age has created this climate crisis. And so we have to have that amount of worldview to understand stuff like you're doing, an entire operation of sustainability. And so at that point, the idea of, oh, should we have cows, it's completely irrelevant.
See, I would go beyond what we've been taught, like in the last couple of years from our young farmer friends, is that it's no longer enough to be sustainable. We have to be regenerative.
Yeah.
And the best way to regenerate soil, the fastest way, is to run it through a rumen, get those animals through there, pooping, peeing, munching, leaving, growing, and that's how you build soil really, really fast.
So you have to change property rights to make more of that possible.
You don't even have to do that. You just have to get people who have land and are doing this kind of grazing.
Cooperate.
To
big enough land.
Yeah, there's enough.
The cows go, place and share the wealth or whatever.
And convince them they can do it. You know, I can move our cows, our steers. And, you know, I have steel-toed boots, but I'm not afraid of them. They are they whine out there if you haven't moved them. You know, they line up along the driveway and look at you every time you go by doing something else, and they're whining. They want to go to the next. They're in a little bigger paddock this weekend so we can be here. And they're just like, what? Why aren't we moving?
How many?
We only have five. And they just line up and they just completely whine at you.
So you can do this with five. You can do it with 1,000. The same principle applies. Yeah.
What you just said brings up a question I've been thinking about this whole time, which is, so sounds like throughout your whole lives you've had this really active activist lives, like you're talking about spending time protesting nuclear installations, being in the cities protesting, and then also running this huge garden and farm and having animals and all that. So how do you make that work?
Well,
we're busy. We're busy, and when people come, we don't think we're, it will feel like I'm in slow-mo, and then I look at the guest that's here, who's just, worn out, and, we've gotten to two things on the list. It's like, what do you mean you're going to do something else? It's like, there's potatoes that need to be dug right now. But,
And do you find that, restorative? Because, I started my first garden this summer, and I'm just learning about this. I feel like I made one salad. I really want to do more, but I also found that I there were a lot of times when I probably could have made more food if I had taken time at the right moment to do it instead of going to a protest or
there's a lot of satisfaction in. You have to look for satisfaction. I love canning. I just love canning. You come to my house. Everything that I love to eat in the middle of when Chad would just oh my gosh, it's 40 below in Wisconsin. How can they live there? I have my canned bruschetta that I can put on that homemade bread that's just cooked on the wood stove. I'm all about that. So I do all that comfort food all in my canning stuff. So I get enormous pleasure out of that. And then again, being able to teach younger people how to can, preserve.
Yeah, that's a big deal.
I teach classes at school, and now some younger farmers are asking me, can you come and show me how to do this? Can we make, people come up and say, your sauerkraut class, I've made it every year since. It's enormous pleasure to see those changes.
Economically is this production what you live on? And if so, you're already saying if it's not, but how much are you working? I have friends doing a similar operation, and it doesn't appear that they sleep.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, how is it like for you guys?
Yeah, well, Mike drives school bus and substitute teaches. He subs both of those. We do everything that we can be able to say no. I do a lot of elder care with my mom, who's 90, in the city, so I do come in, put way too much carbon on, put gas in my car, and do some social work things, teach classes. We do other things to patch up, but we also live at a non-taxable lifestyle, so our, our houses are paid for, our food is, we sell enough food that essentially we eat for free. and then all our other lifestyle choices we've made over the last 37 years, you know, keep us living at a pretty low level.
We've been doing vortex resistance since we got married, and when we had kids, it's easy to write it off to get down below a taxable level, and when they left, it was like, oh, crap, man, we're going to have to change our lifestyle because there's just the two of us. What are we going to do? Well, you start farming, and then you fill out Schedule F. And when you fill out Schedule F, you lose all kinds of money. It's great. You just lose money. It keeps you below the taxable level, and you know, you don't have to pay for war.
And that taxable level is like $14,000, so it's not... You can go to Florida on our Schedule F, but...
So I think we want to talk about that the cow thing. Like there was like a NASA thermal imaging that shows right above Arizona, like the methane cloud.
Yeah.
It has like a higher temperature than the rest of the country.
Yeah.
And that's because of factory farming. It's not because of, you know, what you guys do.
Yeah.
And then I think my question was I read about selective grazing and things too. Is it? So this is still something that we humans are trying to control. Like we're trying to control predator prey.
Yeah, that's you like do that. Right? You do that with electric polywire.
Yeah, yeah. Is there any like nervousness in that? Because we are trying to control nature.
Yeah.
Again.
Yeah.
And is there like any like things that we may not have foreseen that can come into play? And because that's like selective grazing sounds amazing. And you know, you told me that it works too, but
yeah,
we're still trying to like control it with electricity
yeah.
and stuff.
They're really pretty chill. I mean, yeah, they line up to move. It's like when, you know, we don't have any health. Well, we have health care because we're below. We have some state health care stuff. But in terms of just like health, we eat the best food there is, like anywhere. It's just not fair. We actually do try to like we sell our meat. And we sell our vegetables at a level that's more attainable by lower-income people. And one of the things that we try to do with meat particularly, because it is the best meat that there is you know, these restaurants that do so all may eat, so there's no prices where you just go in and people who can afford it put in more money, people who can't afford it are able to put in less. You've heard of these, haven't you? Yeah. We try to do that with our meat. So we kind of ask people who we think can afford it to tax themselves and pay... Because we're giving them a deal because we sell our stuff in Polk County. If we were closer to Minneapolis and selling our stuff in Minneapolis, instead of getting $3.50 a pound for chicken, we could get $6 a pound for chicken. But we don't do that. We try to stay right where we are with all of that. So we really do try to bring a justice element into, you know, like our farm sales. That's really important. And what else? I mean, that's... Yeah.
You talk with other cow farmers about what you're doing?
All the time. I'm on the Northwest Wisconsin Grazers Network Steering Committee. So we have one of the pictures here was a pasture walk we had at our place. I write articles that get in the paper and do education that way. And actually, one of the articles that ran in the St. Paul Pioneer Press about what we were doing was picked up by a guy with the Humane Society, like U.S. Humane Society, and they're starting to form state ag councils to monitor humane treatment of animals, and they invited me to be on it. It's like, I said, I'll try. So I'm like on the U.S. Humane Society state ag council for Wisconsin. And our job is we have all kinds of contact. Our job is to make sure that animals in Wisconsin are treated humanely. I mean, farm animals are treated humanely. Let me really.
Mike, yeah. I don't think we have time.
I'm going to buzz through this.
I think it goes to 5:45.
5:40. Okay. What we're doing here?
We started late. So
what we're doing here is again, it's water. This is all about water. This is in Australia. These methods came out, there's key lines, there's key lines, swales. Mark Shepard is a guy in Wisconsin who wrote a book, Restoration Agriculture, and what he did is he transformed a corn and bean place into it's woody perennials, fruit and nut trees and shrubs that you lay out these swales, and I'll show you what a swale is. It creates a water zone in a pasture, or we do it in a pasture. You can actually use the area between your swales where you plant the woody perennials for anything. You could plant corn and soybeans. You could plant, Mark Shepherd plants asparagus and peppers that he sells to Organic Valley. So it's a combination of these wooded swales. Most people, when they think about farming, it's like you have what you grew down here. But when you're planting in a swale, you've got your raspberries are here, your high bush cranberries are here, your fruit trees are here, your hazelnuts are here, your apple trees or whatever trees you have are up here, and then way the heck up there are oaks and chestnuts and butternuts. And you can either collect all of that for eating or sale, or you can let it all fall on the ground and graze pigs and chickens through. And that's the way to, that's what we're trying to do to get away from soy and corn grain to our pigs and chickens, is the nuts and fruits that we're going to be planting on the swales. So here's us doing it. We went to a workshop at the Lake City Catholic Worker with Mark Shepherd. The first time we went was all theory. The second time we went was out in a 50-acre field with a bulldozer and a laser level. You can get a little more primitive. This is just a transit, homemade transit that we made, and figured out what we wanted to do. So we did some surveying, and what you do is find the it's called the sweet spot. Say you got a valley, and at the bottom of the valley is where you can see when it's raining or when the snow melts, you got these ephemeral creeks, right, streams that run like at the lowest part in a valley, and you start there, and then you survey out to both sides at a 1% downhill grade, and when you do that, you survey, you stick and flag, survey, stick and flag, till you get out to where you're at the end. And you're going to be on a hillside because the valley goes down, and even though you're going downhill, you've got enough valley like on the sides that you're moving water from the wettest areas to the driest areas. So this is way up more than they're doing with contour plowing and with conservation stuff. Grass waterways. There's when we started doing them. This here is the peak of the there was a valley that went right through here, and when the snow melted or when it rained, it just like mainlined it right down in the corner into a swamp, which is fed over here from Devil's Marsh. So this the rain that went down this way isn't feeding the swamp as much as the swamp is feeding the swamp. So this is the low point. You're going out this way and this way, downhill, 1% grade. And then there we are again. did you see on the slides, those were a little more developed in some of the, when we were going through the slides? I'll see if I can throw something on here. These slits here are called key lines, and what I do it with a single shank subsoiler because I have a small tractor, which is just a shank that comes down in the back of the tractor. It's about as long as my arm, and there's a foot, and it's 18 inches deep, and you just drag it through here and make a slit. And what you're doing is going across the contour so that when it rains, the rain is sheeting down the hillside, it hits the slit, falls into the slit fills up, then it goes to the next slit, and so you're slowing the rain down. The point is to collect all the rain that falls on your property and utilize it all. And then what happens at the bottom of these slits is that in order to make compost, you need bacteria, oxygen, and water, and organic material. And when you cut this slit, you've introduced down into the subsoil all of those things. And so in fields where people have been like subsoiling annually for
for years and years and years, they literally start building compost at the bottom of these slits from the bottom up. And Shepherd at his place, when he first started doing it, found an old subsoiler just in the weeds somewhere, started doing it. His soil was so full of clay that it would just stop the tractor. He couldn't even pull the tractor through the clay. And 17 years later, he's got loam. So Sir Albert Howard was all about subsoil. So we started doing that too. There's another swale. There's a good shot of the one with a valley going off downhill, that way, downhill, that way. So then what we did is hit these things with a disc to bust the clods up, did a little bit of raking, did a little bit of maintenance, and then started planting woody perennials on them. And now they're all full of, and then seeded them with grass and legumes and stuff. So they're just lush with growth. And Barb, why don't you talk to them for something? I'm going to see if I can get that this other one in here and see if it'll look good. I'm just going to try it for a second.
We wish we had known this 25 years ago, because our fields would look a lot different. But we just learned this 3 years ago, so we've just jumped right on. One thing that you said today, Chad, that I took that made sense to me, which isn't quite on topic, but kind of is how you did you say it was the Hebrew word for crisis? It is related to the word judgment. But in the Chinese character for crisis is made up of, or the word is made up of two Chinese characters, is danger and opportunity. And it's just, to me, I think I hold on to that more, is as we farm and we see what's going on the planet, we've really tried to take the opportunity to figure out how we can make change just in our 57 acres and hope that in our place, the change that we make, I mean, we have so many people come through our farm, and we feel like we're making an impact because we have so many people come back and say that are looking at farming themselves or looking at land use much differently. And so I think that's where we feel we can make the biggest impact, is just by encouraging other people to do similar stuff and do it better than what we're doing at this time. So those opportunities seem to come our way a lot.
Well, and back to the question of how do we do all our activism and stuff at the same time. I mean, after Project ELF and the Gulf War, then I started going to Iraq with Kathy Kelly and Voices in the Wilderness and taking medicine to children's hospitals, and I started going to Palestine and the West Bank with Barbara Lubin. And while all of that stuff is important, is like still monstrously important in terms of my physical labor, I'm not traveling to those places anymore because I feel like what I'm doing here is like so important, and they appreciate the importance of it because, like, when we were doing anti-nuclear activism, nuclear war might happen. It might happen. And we threw ourselves like headlong into stopping nuclear war. I mean, the first time I got significantly arrested was throwing blood on the White House when Ronald Reagan was president and went to jail for 6 months. And, we were crazy. I was crazy. And then we started doing this stuff with Voices in the Wilderness and traveling to all these areas and all. But nuclear war might happen. Wars, yeah, they happen everywhere. We have a Syrian refugee living with us, been there for 3 years. So we get to see that every day. Barb mentioned that. But climate change is happening. And I look at stuff that I've read that says, like, in 2040, if we don't change anything, there's going to be at least a 4 to 6 foot rise in sea levels by 2040. And in 2040, like, our youngest grandkids are going to be 25. So they're looking at something that's not might going to happen. They're looking at something that is going to happen. And when you have hundreds of millions of climate refugees, like all over the planet, when Miami's underwater and Bangladesh is underwater and Manhattan's underwater, that's a pretty unstable world. So we're farming, right? we are doing everything that we can do. Like, I just loved all the stuff. Like, well, what do we do with water? Our household goes through less than 5 gallons of water a day. We did when we had 3 kids at home. We could tell because before I had the gray water system in, we'd wash dishes, go through everything, brush our teeth, and blah, blah, blah. And we'd haul out about 5 gallons of wastewater under the sink. And it's kind of stayed that way, and it's about five gallons of water a day. We don't poop in water. We recycle all of that stuff. We heat our house with it's solar and wood. Our hot water heater is a solar wood hot water heater because wood is our local fuel, and the sun is like everywhere. I'm a firm believer in nuclear power when it's 93 million miles away, and we don't have hot water on demand. When we need to take a shower with our kids once a week, when they were in school, we fired the shower up Sunday night. They would take showers Monday, go to school, and they were in athletics. And it's like, if you need another shower, take a shower at school. I've gotten to the point where, I mean, it used to be once a week. Then it became once a month. Then it became like maybe once a quarter. But only in the wintertime, because I change clothes a lot. I'm in my sweats, and then I'm in my teaching clothes, and I'm in my bus driving clothes. And it's like, yeah, you know, cleanliness next to godliness, not so much. It's only okay, cleanliness. So our water use is like nothing.
Hey, what about washing your clothes, though?
We have a place on the farm, it's the water building, that actually has a septic system, and the whole community washes their clothes in that building, and it does go in a septic system.
Not gray water?
No, the gray water bypasses it. In Wisconsin, it's a little bit tricky. We just put a bypass in. It's more for volume than anything else. What they say in Wisconsin is, like, if you're in the shower and you're washing yourself and you wash some poop out of your butt, that makes the gray water become black water. Or if you're washing diapers and you skid your underwear, or you got a diaper that you cleaned, that becomes black water. It's pretty dumb. I mean, I appreciate what they're trying to do, protecting water and all. We got busted by the potty police once and got by that, and they basically said, you're using such a little amount of water here that you can just about throw it out the door. So they let us go. But I'm totally inspired by what I'm so glad we're here. You know, all the water stuff and the native stuff, for crying out loud. Our place is in a land trust. We bought it. We have 4 trustees, Plowshares Land Trust. It tells, like, this is what you're, if you live here, you got to do these 4 things. And it just goes on and on. Barb and I had the same thought today after just going through these things here. You know, maybe when it's all done, we did the land trust so that we'd have a place where activists could launch from, like, to do their work. We were thinking today, maybe we need to give it back.
Yeah, we're 2 miles from the rest, so
yeah.
Maybe we
need to figure out how to give it back. Because it's a liberated piece of land right now. It is not for sale. It's, in theory, depending on the trustees, it's just going to go on and on and on, being used for some purpose. So maybe the trustees need to talk that through.
Have you connected with John, former Mennonite Central Committee, Central States guy?
No.
He helps with WAS in looking to get land back to Native, particularly in Minnesota. But,
yeah.
But have you thought about overall just trying, rather maybe than just your land, land in Wisconsin or land near you, to Natives? Because that's sort of a, that you have Wads doing, John Wads doing. Rather than, I mean, from what you're saying.
Well, right now, I mean, we can only handle what's on our plate, and what's on our plate includes being trustees to this land trust, and it's like, okay, so here's some, like, new ideas. I love it when people put new ideas in. It's like, okay, maybe the trustees need to get together and think about this.
My question in front.
Yeah,
have you ever thought about maybe playing your diet with raw cacao nibs that make you, they make you poop and piss more? And they have all sorts of good stuff in this.
Oh, no, I don't know what that is.
It's the nut they make chocolate from.
Oh,
apparently, in the process
of
processing it, you lose the inherent goodness of it, but you make it taste better.
Uh-huh.
But the unprocessed stuff is a superfood. And it also will increase the amount you poop.
and make it even better.
I poop a lot. I'll admit.
Well, you can improve on that.
Good.
Yes.
Can I sing a song for you? Can we to close?
Yeah. To close.
You guys like to sing, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. You like to sing. I write some songs. I haven't sang this for a while, so I don't know if I'll remember the words. It's based on this. You want to read this, and then it's short. I'll sing this song to the nice people. Yeah, and there's a chorus that you can sing along with.
We've had this for a while.
Yeah.
You've been telling the people that it is the 11th hour. They must go back and tell the people that it is the hour, and that there are things to be considered. Where are you living? What are you doing? What are your relationships? Are you in right relations? Where is your water? Know your garden. It is time to speak your truth. Create your community. Be good to each other. And do not look outside yourself for the leader. This could be a good time. There's a river flowing now very fast. It's so great and swift that there are those who will be afraid. They will try to hold on to the shore. They will feel like they are being torn apart, and they will suffer greatly. Know the river has its destination. The elders say we must let go of the shore. Push off into the middle of the river. Keep our eyes open and our heads above water. See who is in there with you and celebrate. At this time in history, we are to take nothing personally, least of all ourselves. For the moment that we do, our spiritual growth and journey comes to a halt. The time of the lone wolf is over. Gather yourselves. Banish the word struggle from your attitude and your vocabulary. All that we do now must be done in a sacred manner and in celebration. We are the ones we've been waiting for. That was from the elders from the Arizona Hopi Nation.
I'll try my best. Eyes wide open, no illusions here. Endless war rages on and on, a river of hate and fear. From the siege of St. Petersburg to the battle for the city of Fallujah, hope springs eternal. Just ask anyone who's lived to see the sunrise. We are the people we've been waiting for. 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 That's your line. Temperatures rising, glaciers melting left and right, hurricanes are blowing, everything in sight. Nature in rebellion, and selected the stupid from the bright. The choice is here before us. Either lay down and die, or put up a good fight. We are the people we've been waiting for. We are the people we've been waiting for. We are the people been waiting for. We are the people we've been waiting for. Corruption overflowing, lying, stealing, cheating, squealing. The rich are getting richer. The rest of us ain't even got a pot to pee in. It's time for revolution. No winners, no losers this time around. All in this together, where justice flows down the mountain like a mighty river. We are the people we've been waiting for. We are the people we've been waiting for.
night. Keep the compassion, restrainers, power and might. Embracing the whole world, loving everybody in sight. Living the golden rule, doing right because it is right to do. We are the people we've been waiting for. We are the people we've been waiting for. We are the people we've been waiting for. We are the people we've been waiting for.
Thanks for your patience. Come and see us. I mean, really, seriously, especially if you're from here, come and see us. We have people come all the time. Facebook, Anathoth Community Farm, that's where all our good stuff is at. We used to put out a newsletter, and we don't anymore. Social media, you reach people who aren't you, you know, that aren't subscribed. You know how that goes. You send out your newsletter, you spend way too much money to people who are in the choir. So we have a website and a really, really good